Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. At the risk of sounding like a cranky old man, again, can I just say that when I was a kid, if there was a number one album in the country, you knew it. Even if you wanted to, chances are you couldn't escape it. Now, unless you're Adele or Rihanna, you could have the top album in the land and most people might never even have heard of it. Like, last week, the number one album on the Billboard charts belonged to rock veterans Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. The Heartbreakers, by the way, includes keyboardist Benmont Tench, who will be playing some of his own music for us here in the Soundcheck studio later. Anyway, Tom and Benmont and the rest of the Heartbreakers topped the charts with their new album called Hypnotic Eye. But have you heard any of it? I thought not. Okay, here's a taste of Tom Petty's chart-topping release. The song is called Fault Lines.
A promise broken, the ground breaks open, love falls through the cracks. And I got a few of my own. I got a few of my own fault lines. Running under my life.
Fault Lines is from the album Hypnotic Eye. It's the new record by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Okay, time to put on your thinking cap, because sitting across from me is our regular guest, Chris Melanfi. He's a pop chart columnist and the author of a recent story that ran on the Pitchfork site called Senior Moments: Why More Albums by Middle-Aged Artists Like Tom Petty and Weird Al Are Hitting Number One. And in a moment, Chris has come up with a kind of pop chart quiz for me and one lucky Soundcheck listener. But first of all, Chris, welcome back.
Thanks so much, John. Good to be here.
So what is happening here? What was the occasion for this article?
Right. So the news peg, if you will, the occasion is the fact that within 3 weeks, actually, we had two number one albums here in America on the Billboard 200 album chart that were both by, let's call them, middle-aged artists who amazingly had never scored number one albums in their careers. And we're talking about recording careers that date back to the 1970s. About 3 weeks ago, the number one album was Weird Al Yankovic's Mandatory Fun, his first number one album ever. And then 2 weeks later, the number one album was Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers' Hypnotic Eye, even more mind-blowingly, their first number one album in a more than 30-year recording career.
That really is. I mean, I'm more surprised by that, because Weird Al, as much as we love Weird Al, he's a novelty act.
Exactly.
And for a novelty album to be the number one album in the land
is exceptional.
Yeah.
In and of itself.
Of course, it is really funny. Listen to this. That is Weird Al Yankovic's version of Robin Thicke's hit song, Blurred Lines. He calls it word crimes. Just for forgetting words like conjugate and nomenclature into the song, he deserved a number one album for that.
Totally. Exactly.
Oh my gosh. So Mandatory Fun, the 54-year-old Weird Al Yankovic's first album, just a couple of weeks ago, and then last week was Tom
first
Petty.
Number one album, yep.
And the Heartbreakers' average age, like 60-something.
63, yeah.
Okay. Why is this happening now?
Well, within 2014, it's exceptional, and it's not a trend within this year, right? Most of the number one albums we've seen this year have been things like the Frozen soundtrack, which is selling to kids, or, you know, Lana Del Rey, who's in her 20s, or Ed Sheeran. Those are the kinds of records that have been topping the charts. However, what I wanted to write about is the fact that over the last decade, there's been this quiet, persistent trend of roughly every year we get another artist breaking this barrier, getting their first number one album after decades. Either it's their first number one album ever, like Weird Al and Tom Petty, or it's their first after a ridiculously long hiatus. We had a Bob Dylan number one album in 2006 for the first time in 30 years. We had Johnny Cash posthumously after he died in 2003. He scored a number one album. It was his first since the late 60s. Ray Charles, the list goes on and on.
Well, but now, you know, it's become the bar, the threshold to get a number one album. It used to be like you had to sell 10 million copies. Now 100,000 records, if it's the right week, could get you that number one spot.
That's right. And in the case of Weird Al, you know, Weird Al just barely eked out a little over 100,000. I believe the number was 104,000, and he got a number one album. Petty's was a little better. It was in the neighborhood of 130,000, and he got a number one album. Admittedly, these are not the kinds of numbers that would have gotten you a number one album most weeks in the 1990s. However, when I did the research, you know, a lot of people said to me, well, of course, it's because the bar is lower now, right? And that's mostly true. It explains why we've seen so many over the last decade. But some of these albums that have been hitting number one have been doing it with blockbuster numbers, the kinds of numbers that really could have threatened for number one in the 90s. And what I really saw, frankly, was that a lot of these artists were hustling, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. They were really finding clever ways to get their music in front of buyers, some of whom may be their own age and, you know, are not buying records regularly, but were made aware. Either they went on the Home Shopping Network or QVC. They teamed with Walmart. In the case of Ray Charles, he teamed with Starbucks. Mm-hmm. Or they found a tweak in their formula. The Isley Brothers had a number one album 10 years ago, and it was because they were working with R. Kelly and getting themselves back on R&B radio for the first time in a long time. Jimmy Buffett went country. You know, several of these people did duets albums. So it's a little bit the bar is lower, but it's a little bit working the angles and finding the hustle.
Okay. Chris Mullanphy is with us here in the Soundcheck studio. You can find his article on our website, soundcheck.org. He wrote it for Pitchfork. It's called Senior Moments, Why More Albums by Middle-Aged Artists Like Tom Petty and Weird Al Are Hitting Number One. Pretty long title. And related to that title is the title of the quiz, Chris, that you have prepared for us today, Senior Moments on the Pop Charts.
That's
so
right.
You're going to be the quiz master.
I am.
I will be one contestant. And joining us on the line is our other contestant. Going head-to-head with me is our listener, Candace from Detroit. Candace, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
How you doing?
I am awesome.
I will bury you.
Oh.
Just fair warning.
Are you trash-talking someone from the Motor City?
Is that not the done thing? I didn't know. what do you do there for a living in the Motor City?
I work in marketing and social media.
Uh-huh. And so how much do you know about, like, classic rock, some of these oldsters that will inhabit this quiz, apparently?
Well, for as much trash as I just talked, not much at all.
All right, so maybe I will bury you.
There's a good possibility.
Candace, this is the second time I've quizzed John, and he takes these quizzes quite seriously, so prepare yourself.
Yeah, but I suck at them, so don't worry.
That's true.
Okay, I feel a little better now.
All right. What you got, Chris?
All right, let's start with question one. And as we may have indicated, these are all going to be multiple choice questions, so, you know.
And who's this one for?
Question one is for Candace. Ready, Candace?
Yes.
Okay. What artist now holds the record for the oldest living performer to reach number one on the Billboard 200 album chart? Is it A, Bob Dylan with Together Through Life? B, Tony Bennett with Duets 2? C, Neil Diamond with Home Before Dark? Or D, Bob Dylan with Modern Times?
Yikes. A lot of AARP members.
That's right.
Let's go with Tony Bennett.
She does it like crap games with barons and earls.
So you did indeed get it right, Candace. The answer was Tony Bennett with Duets 2. He was 85 years old when that album went to number one in 2011. The other three albums I listed there all held the record at one time or another in the last 10 years. Bob Dylan held it twice. Neil Diamond took it from him and Bob took it back. But then they were both decimated when Tony Bennett took it in 2011 at age 85.
All right.
So
Candace,
well done.
Candace, well done there.
So you get
Thank
a point.
Thank you very much.
All right. Wow, we've got a scoreboard here and everything.
I know. So. I get to flip the numbers over. This is very exciting.
All right.
All right, so let's go to the next question. And this one's going to be for John.
If I don't see you again.
Neil Diamond's Home Before Dark, which I just mentioned in the last question, released in 2008, was his first number one album ever. But he came close once before, way back in 1973, when his Jonathan Livingston Seagull album peaked at number two. What blockbuster 1973 album prevented Neil's album from hitting the top? Was it A, the Allman Brothers with Brothers and Sisters? B, Elton John with Goodbye Yellow Brick Road? C, the Rolling Stones with Goat's Head Soup? Or D, Led Zeppelin with Houses of the Holy?
Well, it was certainly not Goat's Head Soup. What a what a disappointment that was.
For the record, all four of those were number one albums in 1973.
Yeah, I had Goat's Head Soup, and it was just bad,
yeah.
Even for a Rolling Stone fan like me. I'm going to go with Elton John. Score!
Ding, 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 indeed. Yes, Elton John, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. I was number one at the end of that year in November and December of 1973, and it blocked poor Neil Diamond from going to number one with his Jonathan Livingston Seagull album.
All right. So do I get a point on the board?
You do. We are now tied up at one apiece, and this next question goes to Candace. Candace, you ready?
I sure am.
All right, here we go. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers came close to hitting number one a couple of times before, most notably in 1980, when their 1979 album Damn the Torpedoes got stuck at number two for 7 weeks behind Pink Floyd's The Wall album. Now, Torpedoes' success was fueled by its classic songs, including the only top 10 hit on the Hot 100 of Petty's career with the Heartbreakers. He scored one more top 10 hit solo, but this is the only top 10 hit he ever scored with the Heartbreakers. Is it Even the Losers, B, Refugee, C, Don't Do Me Like That, or D, Here Comes My Girl?
Oh, who? Let's go with A.
Don't do me like that.
I am so sorry, Candace. The correct answer was C, Don't Do Me Like That, his only top 10 hit with the Heartbreakers. Now, here's the thing. You have a chance to redeem yourself here. Would you like a bonus question for an extra point?
Of course I would.
Of course you would, right? There's only one good answer to that. So, as I said, Tom Petty has only had one other top 10 hit, and it was on one of his solo albums. What was Tom Petty's only other top 10 hit, a track from one of his solo albums without the Heartbreakers?
Oh, I have to call the song out loud?
You do.
It was the song where he was on the escalator in the mall that used to play on MTV all the time.
Yes. Oh, you're so warm.
Oh, I'm so close to it. go up the elevator, sir.
Am I giving it
free
to both
falling.
Of you? That is correct. Free Falling is correct. My goodness. Wow.
Yeah.
Pulling it out at the end.
Well done.
Very well done.
Thank you. I
thought Free Falling, and then when you came up with the escalator thing, I was like, what the hell is that?
Yeah. No, because it's his ode to L.A., and he's on an escalator in a mall.
I guess I just never
Good memory,
with
Candace. Well done.
All right.
Yeah, I'm free.
We're going to go back to John for this next question. Are you ready, John?
Yep.
Okay. So when the album 13 by Black Sabbath hit the top in 2013, it became the band's first U.S. number one album and only its second in the U.K. Amazingly, they'd never come close before. In America, only one other Black Sabbath album had so much as reached the top 10. What was that classic Sabbath album? Was it A, Master of Reality, B, Volume 4, C, Paranoid, or D, Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath?
Gosh. I want to say Paranoid, but I suspect that that's a little early for that. I'm going to go, it's either A or B. I'm going to go with A, Master
for Reality.
I want to find the sweet name. Oh.
That is Sweet Leaf. That is indeed from Master of Reality. John got it absolutely correct. Master of Reality peaked at number 8 way back in 1971, and prior to the album 13 in 2013, it was Black Sabbath's only top 10 album of any kind.
All right.
So another point for John. We're tied, heads up here. And we're going to go to the next question, which of course goes to Candace. Candace, you ready?
Yes.
I was thinking about Lisa Keys. Couldn't keep him quiet, but she was born in Hell's Kitchen. I was living down the line.
When Bob Dylan went back to number one in 2006 with Modern Times, it was his first trip to the top of the album chart in 3 decades. What was his last number one album before Modern Times? Was it A, Planet Waves, B, Blood on the Tracks, C, Desire, or D, Street Legal?
B.
Here comes the story of the hurricane.
And that song, Hurricane, is from Desire, which was
wow.
C, and that was the correct answer. The first three that I named all did go to number one, Planet Waves, Blood on the Tracks, and Desire, but the last one in the 70s for Dylan was Desire, and that was his last number one album until Modern Times in 2006. So I'm sorry you did not get that one correct, Candace, I'm afraid.
It's a hard knock life.
good attitude. I like it.
I'm wiping the sweat from my brow there in relief that I didn't, because I would have said the same thing.
Yeah. No, that's a tougher. All right, so John, are you ready for your question?
I am.
All right, this one's about Sade. Sade returned to number one in 2010 with the album Soldier of Love, her first chart topper in 24 years. Sade's only other number one album contains her, or their, if we're talking about the band, best performing single on the Hot 100. What was that album and that single? Was it A, Diamond Life, featuring the single Smooth Operator? B, Promise, with the single The Sweetest Taboo. C, Stronger Than Pride, with the single Paradise. Or D, Love Deluxe, and the single No Ordinary Love.
Oof. You want the last one that she hit number one with.
Yep, and it contains her biggest hit.
I'm going to go with Smooth Operator.
You give me the sweetest taboo.
Curses!
Indeed.
Foiled again!
It was Promise, her only number one album prior to the 2010 number one album, and it contained The Sweetest Taboo. For the record, both Smooth Operator and The Sweetest Taboo peaked at number 5, but The Sweetest Taboo is on the charts just a little bit longer. It is Sade's biggest hit in the U.S. So, we are still tied at 2 apiece, so tough round for both of you there. Candace, are you ready for the next question?
I think I am.
All right, here we go. Johnny Cash's posthumous album, American 5, 100 Highways, was the only album in his American series with producer Rick Rubin to top the chart. The series consisted largely of covers of by Johnny Cash of other famous artists' songs. Which of these singer-songwriters has a song on American 5 for the first and only time in the American album series? Are you ready? A, Bruce Springsteen, B, Trent Reznor, C, Beck, or D, Nick Lowe?
Where the road is dark and the seed is so.
Candace, you said Beck. Unfortunately, that is Further On Up the Road by Bruce Springsteen. And that is the only time a song by Bruce has been on the American album series by Johnny Cash. So I'm afraid the answer was A.
I've got a little bit of the sads, I got to tell you.
Yeah, I understand. I know that feeling. John, next question is for you. Are you ready?
I am ready to wrest the lead away from poor struggling Candace there in Detroit.
Okay. Ray Charles earned his last number one album posthumously with the Grammy-winning album Genius Loves Company. It hit the top in 2005, a year after his death, just after winning the Album of the Year Grammy. Which of these artists does not duet with Ray Charles on the album? Does not duet.
Okay.
A, Norah Jones. B, Van Morrison. C, Willie Nelson. Or D, Tony Bennett.
I smell a rat here. I'm going to say D, Tony Bennett.
All right, let's hear the answer.
I will feel a glow just thinking of you.
You did indeed call it right, John. The answer was Tony Bennett. Counterintuitively, Tony Bennett, who has recorded duets albums of his own.
With everybody.
And he was on Frank Sinatra's duets album in the 90s. Tony Bennett, oddly, was not on Ray Charles's duets
Tony
album.
Tony Bennett recorded a duet with Candace from Detroit at some point, I'm sure.
Right, Candace?
It
you remember that.
Yes, it went to number nothing.
All right, come on, flip over the scoreboard now, there.
It's been so long since I've put a point on the scoreboard. Okay, I'm now flipping it over. It's now 3-2, John Schaefer. But Candace, the next question is for you. This is a chance for you to take it back. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right, here we go.
With aluminum foil. Never settle for less. That kind of wrap is just the best. To keep your sandwich nice and fresh.
Weird Al Yankovic finally reached number one this year with his album Mandatory Fun. He hasn't scored a number one single on the Hot 100 yet, but he has made the top 10 just once with one of his classic parodies. Which of these songs was a top 10 hit for Weird Al? A. Amish Paradise, a parody of Coolio's Gangsta's Paradise. B. White and Nerdy, a parody of Chamillionaire's Ridin'. C. Eat It, a parody of Michael Jackson's Beat It. Or D. Smells Like Nirvana, a parody of Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit.
If it isn't Eat It, I'm quitting immediately.
All right, so that's your final answer.
Yes, Eat It.
Roll on my Segway. I know in my heart they think I'm white and nerdy.
Think I'm just too white and nerdy.
I hope you haven't quit already, Candace. The correct answer was, in fact, B, White and Nerdy, his parody of the Chamillionaire number one hit, Ridin' or Ridin' Dirty.
I am disappointed in the American appetite.
You know what?
Weird Al.
I am with you on that. For the record, Eat It peaked at number 12 back in 1984. It just missed the top 10. White and Nerdy, which made it to number 9, is Weird Al's only top 10 hit.
So there we go.
I'm so responsible for that.
So with a final score of 3-2, I believe our host, John Schaefer, is the winner of this quiz.
What do I get?
My eternal respect and bragging rights, John? I don't know.
Do I have to go to Candace's house in Detroit to exercise those bragging rights?
You might have to, yeah.
We are always taking guests.
You're a magnanimous loser, right, Candace? You'll accept John in your home.
I truly am, and you come to Detroit, we'll take you to the Motown Museum, all sorts of wonderful things, so come on, John, come visit me.
All right, and Candace, I assume you listen to us on WDET there in Detroit.
Absolutely, big fans of them.
All right, Candace, thanks so much for playing our game today.
Thanks, Candace.
All right, thanks for having me.
And Chris Malanfi with us in the Soundcheck studio, and his Senior Moments on the Pop Charts quiz, inspired by his Pitchfork article, Senior Moments, Why More Albums by Middle-Aged Artists Like Tom Petty and Weird Al Are Hitting Number One. Find a link to it at soundcheck.org. Chris, good to see you.
Thanks, John. This was lots of fun.
Okay, since we've mentioned Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers a couple of times, here's another quiz question for you. Which member of the Heartbreakers this year released his debut album at age 60? Answer, the band's keyboardist and pianist, Benmont Tench. We'll listen to his performance in the Soundcheck studio next. And later, the story of the Rainbow Tribe, the multicultural family adopted by singer, activist, and actor Josephine Baker. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. If you're a Tom Petty fan, the kind that has followed them from their debut in 1976 to hits like this one, Refugee, all the way up to the new album, Hypnotic Eye, then you know that fella behind the keyboards. Benmont Tench is an essential part of that Heartbreakers sound. But you might not know that this gentlemanly, well-traveled backing musician has been crafting his own songs. This year, for the first time in a career that spans nearly four decades, he released a solo record, with a little help from his friends, like Ringo Starr. Benmont Tench joined us earlier this year to play songs from the record called You Should Be So Lucky. Here he is with Veronica Said, Benmont Tench, in the Soundcheck studio.
Veronica Walker stared at the ring on her hand. She said nothing in life goes according to plan, for you cannot control what you can't understand. So you make what you can of the moment. Veronica shivered and paused for effect, pulled a windbreaker tight, lit a fresh cigarette. She said nothing turns out like you led to expect, so you take what you have and you hold it. And the wind's blowing cold on the waterfront tonight, and the winter's so close you can taste it. We got nothing but plenty of time on our hands, and so many ways we can waste it, waste it. Veronica straightened and looked at the sky, turned her back to the moon as it started to rise. She said, not every word in this world is a lie. Those who cannot trust cannot be trusted. And the wind's blowing cold on the waterfront tonight. The winter's so close you can taste it. We got nothing but plenty of time on our hands, and so many ways we can waste it, waste it. Inconceivable blow, but wherever you are and wherever you go, there is one thing to say, there is one thing to know. So hold on to this tight and hold on to this close. It'll serve you and save you in high and high low, that whatever the depth to which you sink below, no true innocent can be corrupted. Blowing cold on the waterfront tonight. The winter's so close you can taste it. We got nothing but plenty of time on our hands, and so many ways we can waste it. And the wind's blowing cold on the waterfront tonight. And the winter's so close you can taste it. We got nothing but plenty of time on our hands, and so many ways.
Ben Montench, live at Our Piano, and his song called Veronica Said, which is part of Ben Mont's new record called You Should Be So Lucky. Ben Montench, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Hey, how are you?
Good, good. On the album, you play that song on guitar.
Yeah, on the album, it's on electric guitar.
When did you start playing guitar?
When I was about 10.
Uh-huh.
And I'm terrible at it. That one, for some reason, I played guitar on the record, it worked fine. But when I play it by myself on the guitar, it doesn't quite have the same thing. It's an entirely different character on the piano, but I thought, what
the heck?
Did
you write it on the guitar?
I wrote it on the guitar, yeah.
Mm, okay.
Absolutely.
We know you as an ace keyboard player. I would have just thought that that's the instrument you go to when it's time to write a song.
I write a lot of them when I'm just walking down the street or driving in the car without an instrument anywhere nearby. And then when I get home, I have to figure out what to do. That one I wrote on the guitar, though.
Yeah. So you've been writing these songs now for how long? I mean, your career goes back almost 40 years.
I've been writing songs since I was a kid, and the oldest song on this record is probably from 78 or something like that. And the newest song on the record was written, you know, 2 weeks to 30 days before the record was recorded.
The album's called You Should Be So Lucky, and Tom Petty appears on a track playing bass.
Yeah, because when I first played with him, he was the bass player.
Mm-hmm. Ryan Adams, Don Was, is on this record.
Yeah, Don's known as a producer, but he's one of the best bass players I can name.
Yeah.
He's one of my favorite bass players.
Gillian Welch and David Rawlings. How did Ringo Starr end up playing Tamburino Magnifico? I think I've said that right.
Well, I mean, what else would you call it?
I don't know.
You know, it's
did you call Ringo
tambourine.
In to specifically play tambourine?
No, we're friends. And originally I wanted him to play drums on the song that Tom played bass on. But we got our wires crossed as to what day I was cutting it. So he wasn't free. And we cut it with Jeremy playing drums. And Jeremy Stacy, who played the rest of the record
right.
as well. Jeremy's a great drummer, so I was thoroughly happy with what he did. But when I talked to Ringo, I was like, oh, well, heck, man, come on in. And there was something that wasn't working between the way the vocals went and the way the instruments went. And he put the tambourine on, and it just worked.
Blonde girl in a blue dress, she's walking away from me. She's standing so still, but she's walking away. Green eyes on the blue day, black birds in a field of white. Blonde girl in a blue dress, and she's walking away. Have you ever come so close? Have you ever just touched down? Have you ever come so close that you could almost...
Ben Montench from the album called You Should Be So Lucky. That's called Blonde Girl, Blue Dress, with Ringo Starr on tambourine, Tom Petty on bass, Gillian Welch and David Rawlings helping out with guitars and harmonies. And
yeah.
So it's a star-studded album. Now, you mentioned, Benmont, that when you first met Tom Petty, he was a bass player. How did you meet Tom Petty?
Well, I saw him around. He was one of this crowd of older kids that worked at a music store that I haunted from when I was about 11. And they were very sinister looking. They had longer hair, and turns out they were all in a band. And since they were about 3 years older than I was when I was 11, they were very, you know, like, that's a big age difference.
Yeah.
And then a friend of mine started helping them carry their equipment around. And a couple of years later, you know, I went to see them play, and they said, sit in some night. And I sat in, and I played with them whenever I was home from college, and eventually I quit college. My father was a judge, and I quit college. And I basically chicken quit college. I didn't tell my dad I wasn't going back because I knew there'd be hell to pay. And so time comes to go to college, and I just don't go. And eventually he and my mom got wise. And he was pretty mad. And Tom talked to him and said, look, I don't know what Tom said to him, but because my dad was a very wise man who was not going to be fooled by anybody, but Tom talked to him, and my dad didn't throw me out of the house. I always figured Tom talked to him to keep me from crashing on Tom's couch, you know?
So the album's called You Should Be So Lucky, solo album by Ben Montench. It is your, it's your first solo record,
Yeah, I've
right?
never done this before.
Why now?
Because it was time to do something scary. And because Glenn Johns had said over the years, let's do a record, and I finally went, what the heck am I doing not taking him up on this offer?
Right. So you Glenn know. Johns, who produced Led Zeppelin and, I mean...
Yeah, he engineered the first Zeppelin record, produced the first couple Eagles record, produced some Faces stuff, you know, engineered a ton of Rolling Stones, for the Beatles,
yeah.
Good
yeah.
Lord.
So,
it goes on and on and on and on. I think he may have done You Really Got Me for the Kinks. He may have engineered that.
Glenn Johns produced. The album is called You Should Be So Lucky. My guest is Ben Montench. Now, the next song you're going to play on the album, this one is on piano, but you're about to play it on guitar.
I like the mood of it better on the guitar, and I'm not a guitar player.
as you told us before.
So I'm gonna give it a shot.
All right.
You know.
Well, there's the guitar. You want to strap it on?
Let me see if I can figure this one out.
Ben Montench is my guest on Soundcheck, pianist, guitarist, vocalist, songwriter. The album's called You Should Be So Lucky, and this is the title track in a live performance here in the Soundcheck studio, Ben Montench on guitar.
Well, you should be so lucky. You should be so sly as to take my fancy, as to strike my eye. Yeah, you should be all that. You should have such stuff. Well, you should be so lucky that I would give. Who told you I was looking? Who said that I was out for any piece of the action that you were all about? Did you think you're so high? Did you think me so low? Did you think you were the question to which I couldn't say no? Well, you should be so lucky. Life should be so sweet as to find yourself one man that's worth a tenth of me, with a heart so strong and an eye so clear. Well, you should be so lucky as to make it out of here. From the day we met, I knew that we were meant for disgrace or glory, hell or heaven bent. Look into my eyes, my little baby blue. Bend your ear to my lips and let me tell you the news. Under another sky, under another sun, maybe some other guy could say that you were the one. But that's another story, and this one's already been told. I hate to spoil the ending, but you are coming in from the cold. Well, ain't the river pretty? Just like a picture book. Come and walk beside me. We'll take a closer look. Show a little trust. Put your hand in mine, and I'll show you lucky while the waters rise. Yeah, you should be so lucky. Your life should be so sweet as to find yourself one man that's worth a tenth of me. You should be all that. You should have such stuff. Well, you should be so lucky. But now your luck is all used up. Yeah, you should be so lucky. But now your luck is all used up.
That's Ben Montench at our piano with You Should Be So Lucky. From the album of the same name, it's out now, and this has been a lot of fun, Ben Mont. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me in.
Thank you.
song Wobbles from Benmont Tench. He's out on tour with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers this summer and fall. Up next, inside singer Josephine Baker's large, idealistic family of adopted children, or as she called them, the Rainbow Tribe. That's next on Soundcheck.
I want to go where you go, do what you do, love when you love, and I'll be happy.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The story of the singer, actress, and activist Josephine Baker has many chapters. She rose to fame as a risque hot jazz act in 1920s Paris. Performing in her trademark banana skirt, Baker was a muse for artists and writers like Langston Hughes and Pablo Picasso. During World War II, she gathered intelligence for the French resistance and earned a French War Cross. In the 1950s and 60s, she became a figure in the American Civil Rights Movement. But there's another chapter in Josephine Baker's story that you might not know about, and a new book focuses on it. It's called Josephine Baker and the Rainbow Tribe. Matthew Pratt Gutterl is the author. He's also professor of Africana Studies and American Studies at Brown University. Matthew, welcome to Soundcheck.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So what does the title Josephine Baker and the Rainbow Tribe refer to specifically?
So the Rainbow Tribe is the family that she assembles starting in the early 1950s and builds through the early 1960s. She gives it a name, the Rainbow Tribe, as a way to sort of connect it to visions of common humanity, multiculturalism, multiracialism.
So she assembles the family.
Yes, quite deliberately.
Mm-hmm. And is specifically trying to, you know, kind of cross races and ethnicity and religion with her family.
Yes, as carefully and as deliberately as she can, she's looking for balance and representation across the spectrum of colors and races and peoples. And she wants a family that serves a deeply symbolic purpose in the context of conversations about decolonization, civil rights, human rights.
Where is she in her career at this point? You say this is like the 1950s, and we think of Josephine Baker as very much a person of the 20s and maybe 30s.
You know, it's interesting. She was rumored to have died during World War II and had a major comeback in the late 1940s and early 1950s, and had a fairly successful tour of the United States, which ended rather dramatically with her confrontation with a U.S. journalist and her labeling as a communist and her blackballing in the U.S., and she was sort of pushed adrift. Sent down ultimately through Brazil to Argentina, where she spoke out angrily and vociferously against Jim Crow. So she's had the successful career, but she's now at political odds with the culture of the United States, and she returns to France in that context and begins these adoptions.
Well, you know, for folks who know the name Josephine Baker and can't quite place her, here is one of her great hits from those early days, and the song is called J'ai deux amours, I Have Two Loves. A little bit of Josephine Baker's recording of J'ai deux amours, I Have Two Loves, a career that began with kind of salacious dancing in Paris in the 1920s. She was, though, Matthew, a serious artist, you know, felt very strongly about her music and her stage presence. And, you know, we begin, as she matures as an artist, as a person, we begin to see these other sides of her. The Rainbow Tribe, at what point does she come to the conclusion that her own experience as a black woman in Europe needs to have some kind of additional outlet other than on stage?
That's a great question. I mean, I think she's always more than her stage persona. She's advertising products. She's creating
what we would now call a brand.
Yes, a brand. She's attempting to incorporate herself, right, in the language of Oprah. And she's always looking for accompaniments as well. So on stage or on screen, she often has, you know, pets, small children, lovers. She's never really alone, except for a few scenes in a few movies. She often has something with her, a compliment of some kind.
Oh, miss, vous avez donné tout. Et moi, j'en vous laisse un petit bout.
Tiens, tiens,
pour
tiens,
voir
tiens.
Si vous avez raison de trouver ça si bon.
Ne vous désolez pas, voyons.
But it's really after World War II, and specifically after her trip to Argentina, that she comes to the idea that a bigger ensemble, supporting cast of young children could be brought together to augment her personality, to indicate direction, where she mm-hmm. thought the world should mm-hmm. go, and to give some sense of her role in human history.
And in terms of having kids of her own, it's important to say that every member of the Rainbow Tribe was adopted, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So just the fact that she spent some of the war years, you know, working for the French Resistance shows that, you know, already she was thinking in terms of her place in the world. And the Rainbow Tribe kind of reflects this sort of global embrace. She wanted to adopt an Israeli kid. She wanted a, mm-hmm. you know, a Jewish member of the family. And that didn't quite work out, right?
No, she wanted to. There were several attempted adoptions that never really came to pass. So one was her effort to secure an Israeli child, which she wasn't where she failed, primarily because the state of Israel desperately needed human capital. And
they
and
said, why would we send an Israeli kid to you when we're trying to get Jewish kids to come to Israel?
Exactly. Yeah. So she adopted a child from France and assigned him a Jewish identity. She also wanted to adopt a Native American child, and that too fell by the wayside. Mm-hmm. But she managed to find another child who was indigenous, though from South America, and to include him in the family too.
And they all lived in this remarkable place that is, to contemporary readers, might strike echoes of Michael Jackson's Neverland and Disneyland. And tell us about her little world. Yeah. For the Rainbow Tribe.
It's an extraordinary place. And if anybody who's listening ever has a chance to go to the Dordogne, they should go to Les Milans, which is now a museum run by a lovely woman who was very helpful to me. It's a big old castle that Baker painstakingly restored in the 1940s and that she turned into a theme park with amusement car rides and polo courts and tennis courts and canoe rides and a series of bars and hotels, mm-hmm. And in the middle of this, there was the domestic site of the castle itself. Much like Disneyland and Disney World, the castle sits at the middle of the enterprise, and the family was raised there.
And this is where the story begins to get a little more unusual and perhaps for contemporary sensibilities, a little more complex, because
right.
you call it a theme park. And who are the star attractions in this theme park?
Well, the star attractions are the children themselves. That what's being advertised here is a vision of the future, and Baker encourages her public in France and globally to come visit the Dordogne and to come to Les Milans and to see what the future might look like, to watch these children play together out in the public air. And so there are a series of glorious photographs that I included in the book of Baker playing with the children in front of the closed gate. The audience is outside anticipating entry. Everyone's staring at the children and watching them. And it's important to remember that this is 1953, 54, 55. You know, this is a fairly radical vision at the time. This is mm-hmm. the moment at which swimming pools are being closed. You know, the Brown decision has just passed. In the U.S. side of things, the racial situation is getting worse, not better in the short term.
We're speaking with Matthew Pratt Goodirl. He's the author of the book called Josephine Baker and the Rainbow Tribe. 12 kids, is that right?
That's right.
And it becomes kind of an extension of her own performing career. There's a song that she did earlier on called Dans Mon Village, In My Village, mm-hmm. Which after the family breaks up, and we can talk about how that happens in a moment, but throughout the 1960s, she continues to sing this older song, and the resonance and the meaning of the lyrics about, you know, a village where people can gather and can serve all men as bright witness, it has changed for her and for her audience because of what she's gone through.
No, exactly. When she has the children on site at Les Milans and she's performing for people who are visiting. She has a small theater down by the river that she uses to perform. She'll bring the children out, or the children will be in the front row, and she'll gesture to them. Later in life, when the children have grown up and are no longer the kind of petite, easily controlled symbols that they once were, she will bring small children up from the audience and have them sit on stage around her and sing to them. So they become a very stylized, very It's a Small World referent for yeah. her.
The song is Dans mon village, Josephine Baker.
Dans mon village, tout ça qu'il m'aime. Dans mon village, tout ça qu'ils grandiront. Et comme moi, je sais qu'un jour, ils chanteront les deux amours. Ce beau village, et puis celui de leur pays.
Josephine Baker singing Dans mon village, kind of, well, as Matthew has said, it's kind of her version of It's a Small World After All, this hope that people can be seen without thought of race or color, as the lyrics say. Matthew Pratt Goodearl is professor of Africana Studies and American Studies at Brown University. His book is called Josephine Baker and the Rainbow Tribe, about Josephine Baker's quixotic attempt to create a kind of multiracial, multi-ethnic, multinational family. And Matthew, for you, this is personal, isn't it?
In a way, yes. You know, I come from a fairly large, though not quite that large, adoptive family, raised in a small town in a house with a white picket fence. My parents had many reasons to adopt, but among them, my father used to say, was the desire to sort of bring together people of different races. He often said that jokingly, so I'm never sure whether he was serious, but it's interesting that that language was out there. And I remember vividly as a child multiple instances where the three of us who were closest in age and who represented, you know, the three great racial divisions of the world or whatever, were brought out to deliver the gifts up to the altar at a holiday mass, or I often felt on display, or felt as if I was serving some kind of symbolic purpose, not necessarily for my parents, but for people in the town. And the number of times I heard people say, your father's a saint, your parents are saints. It's a very interesting experience as a child to imagine that your parents, in creating this family, have contributed to a kind of human rights or civil rights mission.
And did you at some point begin to think, well, I don't want to be on display, you know? I'm a teenager now. I'm too cool for this stuff. I mean, you know.
Yeah, no, I always, quite frankly, hated that feeling of surveillance and public watching, and always wished to fade into the background. And it was incredibly difficult. Didn't help that my father had a Suburban that was bright orange and sort of called attention to the family. But
so the family mobile would come down the street and everyone
yes,
knew what that
right,
meant.
Exactly.
So Josephine Baker herself, she dies suddenly in 1975. The family, you know, has sort of broken up in the 60s. What happened to the kids? I mean, do they still think of each other as family, as siblings? Do they maintain contact?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what happens, she dies a classic entertainer's death, right? So on the eve of her last great performance, and the family is split up largely because the younger children are in various kinds of educational institutions, some of them in boarding schools, some of them with friends and relatives. The older children are living in apartments and are on their own. And they have to come together at this great final funeral in Paris. And I think they do come together. I know that they continue to think of each other as family. They're in touch. They have a network. They're split by generational demographics, it seems to me, that there's definitely an older group and a younger group.
Well, that's normal for a big – I mean, I'm from a large family, and I know my younger brothers and sisters. I'm more like an uncle to them than an older brother. So
right.
that dynamic, you know,
right.
certainly is – for Josephine Baker, was this experiment a success?
You know, that's another great question. I think it was a success in some ways, but probably not in others. I think that she, I think that she was displeased with the way that it ended. And, you know, because she, as much as she imagined these children as symbolically important in her battle for civil and human rights, she also recognized, not always completely and sometimes episodically, that they were also children who required a mother and a parent, that they were complex emotional creatures and human beings. At times, she seems much more invested in the symbolic function of the children, especially as a group, than she is in the inner lives or complexities of each individual child. That's kind of a feature of some of these large adoptive families as well, the sense, as Dorothy DeBolt once put it, that you don't need to know the names of your children. You just deal with the bigger issues when they're in front of you.
Well, there were some pretty big issues that Josephine Baker was facing throughout her life, and which certainly color the story in Matthew Pratt Goodrell's book. It's called Josephine Baker and the Rainbow Tribe. It is out now, and it is really just one more astonishing chapter in what was an amazing life story. So, Matthew, thank you very much for sharing it with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll look back at Definitely Maybe, the debut album from Oasis, which was released 20 years ago this month. Plus, sunny West Coast harmonies and irresistible hooks from the group known as In the Valley Below. They'll play live. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team. With Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac, the show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, and Mike Katzeth, with Amy Pearl, and our interns Haley Shaw and Micah Lowinger. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.